right, welcome everyone back to New Books in Education on the New Books Network. I'm here from Teachers College at Columbia University, which I think is apropos definitely for today's discussion. Today I'm excited to talk with Dr. Bill Derezowitz, and he's going to be talking about his upcoming book titled Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. And this is from Free Press, published this year, or publishing this year. And I'm really excited to talk with Dr. Derezowitz because on my Facebook, on social media, there was this article circulating that he wrote for the New Republic called Don't Send Your Kid to the Ivy League. And it caused a great stir. A lot of people were interested. And that article was sort of based on the upcoming book, you know, try to get eyeballs and people interested. But the book has so much more than, you know, what simply was in that article. So I think it's great that we can actually have the author on to talk to us today. And he does have many years' experience in academia with Ivy League, and now he's been an author for several years as well. Welcome, Dr. Derezowitz. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, sure. First of all, good job pronouncing my name.
thank
but now you must refer to me as Bill, otherwise I will terminate the conversation.
I have no problem with that.
Good. And also, I just want to let people know that the book comes out August 19th. So depending on when this podcast post, it's either about to come out or just came out.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay. And we already there's a link on Amazon. We'll put on there, and people can buy it either way before or after this comes out. So,
great.
Yeah, why don't you if we get started, you know, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your like educational background and sort of how you got into maybe academia in the first place? And you know, you talk about in at least in the article. You're talking about this elite education and Ivy League and things like that. You know, disclosure, which you can talk about. You are an Ivy League man yourself, you know, from Columbia University and taught at Yale. So can you maybe talk a little bit more about that and sort of how you got into this field?
Sure, sure. Well, let me say, first of all, that it's true that one of the reactions to the article has been, but you went to the Ivy League yourself. How could you be saying this? Isn't it hypocritical? And, of course, if I hadn't gone to the Ivy League, people would be saying, you don't know what you're talking about. This is just the sour grapes of someone who couldn't get into the Ivy League.
Right.
So look, I mean, I did end up being in the Ivy League in one form or another for about 24 years. And it gave me the perspective. It opened my eyes to a lot of what goes on, a lot of what's going on there. Why, you know, sort of how I ended up there in the first place, I don't want to make too long a story of it. My dad was actually a Columbia professor, so in some ways I sort of was born into it. And that's really why I went to Columbia College. It was free, and so I knew from before I was born that that's where I was going to be going. But I think that, you know, I say in the book, I identify with these kids. This is not a book about kids today and how awful they are. I think the system has, the system of meritocracy and the problems with it, and specifically elite college admissions and what it does to kids and what it does to society ultimately. This has been true for about 50 years. It just keeps getting worse and worse. So I went through too, and one of the things that happened with me is that I never got any real direction, real advice, real help in figuring out what I wanted to study, what college should be about. I ended up being a science major because my dad was a scientist. And that's a great decision for a lot of kids. It wasn't a great decision for me. I kind of ended up wandering after college for a few years before I realized that I should always have studied English, and I needed to go and study English. I applied to a bunch of graduate schools. Because I had been a science major, very few of them let me in. I ended up back at Columbia because in those days they had, and there were a few schools like this, I think Chicago and UVA, this insane system where they would take a giant first-year class and then cut half of us after the first year. It was like the sickest, worst educational experience you could imagine. I think they don't do this anymore. So they're the only ones who let me in out of about 12 schools I applied to them in Chicago, which had the same system. So I did my PhD at Columbia. I had some bad professors, a couple of wonderful professors who were real mentors for me. and I ended up getting the job at Yale. I think people who are in graduate school or have gone through graduate school will understand when I say that I didn't choose to teach at Yale. It's the only job I got. I mean, you know, I'm not sure. I had a few interviews. I don't know that I would have gotten any of those jobs. I think there are specific reasons why I was appealing to that department, mostly to do with the fact that they're sort of still kind of humanistic in the sort of old-fashioned sense, as I was. And I think for that reason also, because I was always kind of out of step with intellectual currents in literary studies, I wasn't ultimately able to stay in the profession. Another thing that I think people have not understood about me is that I did not leave academia voluntarily. I would love to have continued teaching, and I would love specifically to have continued teaching at a liberal arts college rather than a university, because teaching is really what I cared about. But it just never happened. I just never got that second job. Of course, I didn't get tenure at Yale, which didn't surprise me. So here I am. I'm a full-time writer. But in the course of those years, especially my 10 years on the Yale faculty, I really got to know my students. That's another mistake. Time with my students instead of on my research. And I began to see that there were a lot of problems with the way these kids were being trained, conditioned, where it had left them. I wrote an essay about this 6 years ago called The Disadvantages of an Elite Education. Mm-hmm. That essay went viral. It went viral much more slowly than the New Republic one, but it's continued to have a readership for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And that's led to a lot of campus talks and a lot of correspondence. And to bring a long story to an end, this is a big phenomenon. A lot of people have been contacting me about this, and professors, and like people know this is going on.
Right,
and we can talk about what I mean by this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you just kind of jumping back into something that you mentioned, and then connecting that to the article that a lot of people have read so far, and you can read in the book a little bit more. You talked about you sort of had this, you saw what was going on in the admissions office, and you know what people were looking at.
Yeah.
Can you kind of talk about some of the things that they're looking for and some of the difficulties with the admissions?
Yeah. Let me clarify again first. I mean, the piece was framed in a certain way to attract readers, and that's fine. My claim does not to knowing what's going on does not rest on the one day that I spent in the admissions office, although it gave me an interesting look behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on 15 years of teaching at Columbia and Yale, teaching the products of the admissions process, right? I mean, that's why I know what I'm talking about. And look, I mean, I think we all know what admissions at highly selective universities and colleges, especially universities, expect students to be. You need to do 6 or 7 or 8 AP courses. You need to do 10 or 12 extracurriculars. When kids would come up for an admissions decision who only had 6 or 7 extracurriculars, they were already behind the eight ball because that wasn't, you know, enough. Service, leadership, athletics, musical instruments, foreign travel, the whole thing. I mean, we all sort of know what this hoop jumping childhood is like now.
Mm-hmm.
And that produces a certain kind of person.
Right.
And it's not, I think, the kind of person we want to be producing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of flashbacks from, you know, I did some previous graduate, assistant work in the Office of Admissions for one of the colleges here. And so I saw a lot of this, going abroad and you know, doing service projects abroad. And I was just thinking, oh, wow, you know, I couldn't have done this as an undergrad, or sorry, not undergrad, as a high school student. You know, I worked and had other things. And so I think I connected to that a lot with some of the things that you were talking about.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, never mind the fact that in many ways this system necessarily selects for rich kids. Mm. We can talk about that later.
Sure.
But even before we get to the inequality that it fosters and perpetuates, it creates a certain kind of person. I mean, people have written about this extensively when it comes to the high school kids. There's a book by Denise Clark Pope called Doing School. There's a book by a psychologist named Madeline Levine called The Price of Privilege. So we know that these kids in the affluent suburbs and urban neighborhoods where the upper middle class and the upper class sort of shove their kids into what David Brooks calls the achievement machine. We are training kids to be constantly busy, constantly stressed, constantly pressured, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of physical health issues, and never give them the opportunity and don't seem to be interested in giving them the opportunity to think about what their education is supposed to be for and what their life is supposed to be about. All the goals are taken for granted. And, you know, for some kids, that's fine. And for a lot of kids, it's not fine. Mm-hmm. And they either end up doing something after graduation that's sort of the path of least resistance and most money, like Wall Street, or they kind of feel like they don't know what to do with their lives, and they don't even know how to go about figuring it out. I've heard this from many, many, many students.
Absolutely.
At many schools.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I feel like, again, you know, connecting to a lot of things you said, and, you know, maybe it's one of the things that I was interested. When I got out of school, I certainly didn't know what I wanted to do. I think that's how a lot of students are. I ended up going to South Korea myself, and I think that was a great decision. But not everyone, makes the best decision. But you know, can we get into like you wrote this book, after your first viral article, The Disadvantages of an Elite Education. You know, that came out a couple years ago, six years ago. You said
6 years ago.
Yeah. So is this book kind of an extension of that, or can you kind of describe what was the purpose of you writing?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. I mean, in some ways, this book was sort of, I won't say that it was forced on me, but it is the product of the response I got to that article, which I didn't think anyone would read. But first of all, I realized that this wasn't just my perception. A lot of students wrote to me, and almost all of them said, thank you for putting into words what I've been going through. Mm-hmm. So first of all, there was a big need to talk about this and a big hunger for that conversation about purpose and the meaning of an education. And second of all, as I started to do these campus talks that often students would invite me to do, I would get a lot of questions like, so what are we supposed to do about this? Or what am I supposed to do about this? So the book is in four parts, and the first part is an expansion of that original critique, and I talk about the history of the admissions process, I talk about the role that parents play, I talk about the role that colleges are playing or not playing in trying to deal with this, but that's only the first part. And in the second and third parts, I move on to a positive message about how do you create a sense of meaning in your life, what is college supposed to be for, and maybe it won't surprise you that one of the things I say college should be about is a liberal arts education centered on the humanities, taught by teachers who are well supported in small classrooms. Mm. That's another big part of the book, and it's not sort of liberal arts because it's going to give you instrumental skills. It's about helping you develop as a person. And then the last piece, which is also new, is about the social implications of all of this. Basically, if you look at our leadership class, you see that they have the same characteristics as the students I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. They're timid, risk-averse, intellectually undernourished, very self-serving, very full of themselves, and very out of touch. Mm-hmm. So that's, and then at the end, so in a sense, I lay out the problem. I talk about what individual kids can do to save themselves, and then I talk about what we all need to do as a society, I think, to get out of this.
Sure, sure. What, maybe if you can, you know, don't spoil it for us, but what are some of those tips, or at least a few of them, that you can recommend that students be doing or what they should be doing for this experience?
Right. Well, first of all, don't go to college. Don't go to the most prestigious college that lets you in, because it's the most prestigious college that lets you in, which most students do. Go to a college that you think is going to give you a real education. Sit in on classes when you do your campus visits. Think about what you're going to do when you get there. Don't worry about fancy dorms. Don't worry about fancy climbing walls. Students and families, kids and families make their college choices for all the wrong reasons. It's right. Very much a status competition, prestige competition. You need to step aside from that. Mm-hmm. And stepping aside is another big recommendation I make. I know probably students have heard this before, but it bears repeating. Take time off. Whether it's before college, during college, after college, just first of all, just to let yourself think, let yourself hear what you want, get in touch with yourself, and be in a place where you don't have to hear the messages that you're constantly getting about status, credential, success. I did an event at Stanford a couple of months ago where a student asked this beautiful question about, you know, what are you know, basically, where are our dreams coming from? What is the origin of these dreams that we're all, that are installed in us? That's what kids have to figure out. They have to figure out, are the things that I want the things that I really want, or just the things that I've been taught I should want? Mm. And getting away from it, like I said, taking time off. And not taking time off in the way that a lot of kids do now, to just continue to build a resume of credentials, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you know, you talked about sort of, you know, what kids should be doing. Is it different from maybe, you know, what parents should be suggesting, or how, you know, how does a parent really say something to their student along the lines of, you know, go find yourself kind of thing?
Right. Well, let me say, there's actually one more thing I wanted to add, but it's also very relevant to what you just asked.
Sure.
I would say the third major thing, and this is a hard thing to hear, it's a hard thing to say, but I think it's a truth that has to be told. You can't have it all. You cannot have it all. This is a system that forces you to choose between learning and success, learning in the broadest sense. It forces you to choose between learning and success. So you have to choose. Mm. And you're going to have to give up. You may well have to give up a certain amount of success, whether that's credentials, status, wealth, in order to do something that's meaningful to you.
Mm.
And this is the problem. I mean, I wouldn't say that parents should say anything different to their kids than what I just said.
Right.
The problem is that a lot of parents think they're already saying that.
Mm-hmm.
They say, do what you love, follow your dream. The problem is they don't really mean it. There's a silent addendum that every kid understands, which is, do what you love as long as it is also prestigious, lucrative, high status.
Right, right.
You can't have it both ways, and it's risky. It's
sure.
risky. And you need to recognize, what you need to recognize is that it's a risk either way, because you're taking a risk if you do work that makes you miserable.
Right.
And the risk is that you're going to be miserable.
Sure.
I don't think anyone's ever made themselves happy by chasing status and wealth. Mm. But, and yet we continue to do it.
Absolutely. And do you think, you know, looking back on maybe your own time, or just, you know, some of the research that you put in, do you feel like it's getting sort of, you know, quote unquote, worse for students today? Or has it always sort of been like this, and now we're just sort of more cognizant of these kinds of things?
I'm glad you asked that, because it's important to emphasize that this did not start in 2008 with the financial collapse. I mean, on the one hand, obviously that's made people more concerned about money, and they should be more concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And the growing college costs and growing student debt, these are all real issues that everyone is going to have to think about for themselves. But this is definitely not a product of the last 6 years. I mean, after all, I wrote that article 6 years ago before the financial collapse.
Right.
This is partly the result of 50 years of meritocracy. We can talk about what that means.
Absolutely.
What it means, among other things, is that you're pursuing things exclusively for your own benefit. But it's also a product of 30-plus years of, quite frankly, Reaganism.
Mm-hmm.
And the belief that happiness equals money with a side order of fame.
Mm-hmm.
This is very much about broader social values.
Right.
Which is also to say that, and this is something that I don't think the article communicated, partly because of the way it was framed, is this is not just the colleges. I mean, this is the whole system at which the colleges sit as the keystone of.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you want to maybe go into that a little bit more? You know, maybe the differences that you didn't get a chance to really write. You know, you can't. You know, we know journalism today, you can't have too many words, or potentially, you know, people
Right.
Do you want to talk about maybe just a little bit more of those differences, or some you didn't get to dive into the article that is really well put into the book?
Yeah, right. I mean, in some ways, I've already referred to it. The article is mostly the critique part with little bits of some of the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really get a chance to talk about all the constructive stuff about,
right.
you know, what college should be for, and developing a sense of purpose and all that stuff. But again, also, this is not just the Ivy Leagues in two senses. Mm-hmm. It's a whole bunch of selective schools that go well beyond the Ivy Leagues. I mean, I say maybe 100 schools.
And also,
it's not just what happens in college. It's fundamentally about what happens before kids get to college. But what happens is happens because of the college admissions process. I mean, upper middle class childhoods now are off very, very, very often exclusively geared towards producing people who could get into the Ivy League.
Right, absolutely. And I think that connects greatly with sort of the idea we talked a little bit about a second ago, but if you want to dive more into it with this idea of meritocracy, you know, we always identify meritocracy as sort of, you know, what we strive to be in the United States. But I think what we've kind of elicited here is that potentially, you know, these institutions aren't necessarily a part of a meritocracy, at least not the way we sort of define it ourselves.
Yeah, well, I would say a couple of things about that. The phrase I use in the book is a hereditary meritocracy, which is intended to be an oxymoron. We've developed a system, not consciously, based on all the choices that families have been making, where meritocracy is not actually where everybody gets a chance to rise to the level of their talent.
Mm-hmm.
It is self-perpetuating because wealthier families can stuff their kids full of the educational resources they need to demonstrate merit on an Ivy League college application. So that's the first issue, is that, you know, our meritocracy is no longer truly egalitarian.
Right.
That everybody has the same chance. And then the other issue, and they're related issues, is that the merit in meritocracy is maybe not the merit that we really want to encourage.
Mm.
Nicholas Lehman, in his book about the SATs, The Big Test, talks about this, that the definition of merit has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it tends to reflect what current elites see as their own strengths. Basically, merit is defined as what the people who already have power and wealth exhibit the most of.
Right.
I think we've evolved towards a system where the merit that we're developing in kids is not what we really want from our leaders, from our most talented kids. There's a lot of conformity. There's a lot of course, hoop jumping. A lot of technocratic expertise, but not any kind of very little kind of wider wisdom.
I see.
As I say, they're very good at answering questions, but not so good at thinking up new ones.
Sure. Oh, and so, you know, you mentioned sort of you're talking about, you know, things that, you know, what can we change in the system or with universities, or what are some of those things? Like, how do we make a better meritocracy in our system? How do we do that?
Right. Let me say, first of all, that I don't have all the answers. I mean, I think there are a lot of questions that this book raises that I'm not equipped to answer.
Sure.
I think we want to select for risk-taking, for intellectual curiosity, for genuine independent-mindedness, for real creativity and not sort of conventionally demonstrated creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various things that elite colleges can do to reform their admissions process, limit the number of extracurriculars, refuse to be impressed by any opportunity that's made possible by parental wealth, eliminate preferences for athletes, for legacies. But I think we need to go further than that. I mean, this took me a long time to realize, and it's one of the differences between the original article and the book. I think those schools will only ever go so far because they have a business model that requires them to admit a lot of affluent students.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people talk about how Harvard gives a lot of financial aid. It's true. But 40% of people who go still pay full price. They give financial aid below $180,000 of household income.
Mm-hmm.
So you could still be quite affluent and get financial aid from Harvard, and many people who are do. So ultimately, by reasons of historical accident, we have outsourced the training of our leadership class to a set of private institutions who will always be acting ultimately in their own interest.
Mm-hmm.
What we really need to do is make those institutions irrelevant by creating free, first-rate, public higher education. Mm. And the fact is that there was a time in this country for many decades in the 20th century where we tried to do, and in many cases succeeded in doing, exactly that, most obviously at the University of California. Mm. We pulled back from that commitment starting about 30 or 40 years ago, and there's been an enormous drop in public funding for state higher education.
Right.
Because people don't want to pay for it anymore. Right. Well, if you don't pay for that, this is what you end up with.
Right, right.
You end up with a privatized system and people essentially buying their way into it.
Mm. Okay. Well, and if you could, you know, what universities, what institutions that you've seen out there, that you've witnessed, are at least, you know, making a better attempt than potentially some of the maybe these more elite institutions?
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I'm wary of naming some schools and not others, and partly because there are many, many, many schools, and there are many that I'm not very familiar with at all.
Sure.
I mentioned a couple of things in the article, and I've been criticized for this, but I mentioned public universities and liberal arts colleges. And people have said, well, public universities don't really give a very good education. And people have said, liberal arts colleges are kind of elite themselves. And they're right. Those are two responses to two different problems. If you want to go to a place that's socioeconomically diverse with all the experiential learning that implies, you're better off going to a public university. If you want to go to a place that gives a real liberal arts education, you're better off going to a liberal arts college. It's hard to think of schools that do both.
Mm-hmm.
There are now, I believe, several dozen honors colleges within or honors programs on public university campuses.
Right.
And I think those are certainly one great set of options. Now, beyond that, we can name schools. I mean,
yeah.
You know, people will always cite Deep Springs. You know, Deep Springs is a very, very small institution that, even if people wanted to, only very few people could go to. Mm-hmm. I think there's some liberal arts colleges. I've been very impressed. I live in Portland, Oregon. I've been very impressed at Reed and how extremely academically rigorous it is. But you know what? I think there are also a lot of what you might call regional liberal arts colleges, like Lawrence University in Kansas or Berry College in Georgia, and probably a lot of others that, like I said, I've quite frankly never heard of.
Sure.
That really, you know, that really do a good job because they're really committed as much as they can be in today's climate to, you know, again, a genuine liberal arts education and not training to enter the global elite, is really what the Ivy Leagues and Stanford and so forth, that's what they're for.
Sure, sure. So, you know, sort of after talking and hearing about the book, you know, who's your audience? Who are you hoping picks this up and reads it and makes, you know, attempts to, you know, follow some of the things or at least think about some of the things that you wrote about?
Everybody.
Okay.
I want everybody to read it. And I will, let me just say that I'm going to be in Chicago on my book tour in November. I was invited by a group of parents on the North Shore. The North Shore is sort of the fancy part of what they call Chicagoland.
Right.
And it looks like I might be doing an event at the University of Chicago and another event at a big law firm downtown.
Sure.
So that's three different groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I've been talking to students for the last 6 years, but parents have started to pay attention. I think parents are very concerned about this. So students, right. Parents, why does a law firm want me to talk to them? Well, I mean, I think people recognize that these issues impact on, like I said, on leadership. And what does that mean? How should our leaders be trained, and what does leadership mean in the first place? And of course, listen, this is a podcast that's coming to us from Teachers College. I mean, a lot of professors, a lot of high school teachers, I mean, professors are often disconnected from actual teaching and education, but enough of them care about this and want to care about this. And administrators, I think, they tried to ignore me, but I think some of them, especially liberal arts colleges. I'm going to be talking to the Annapolis group in a couple of months, which is sort of the group of liberal arts college presidents.
I see.
So yeah, I mean anyone who cares about American society, I think, because this is why this is relevant to everyone.
Right.
Again, because this is the system that's producing our leaders.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I think that's a really great answer. And hopefully, from the podcast, we can get all our audience to be interested and listen to things like that. If you could, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, you've heard some of these criticisms after the article. What were some of the criticisms that you've already received, and sort of what you're sort of potentially bracing yourself for, or, you know, if you want to say, you know, what did they get right? What did they get wrong? What do they misunderstand? If you could.
Well, of course, I don't think they got anything right, because I think it's perfect. But
right.
Yeah, look, I mean, there are some patterns in the criticism. The first is, you know, sort of the how do you know pattern. My experience was different. Some of these are written by people who are still undergraduates, so their experience is incredibly limited. The fact is, like I said, a million plus people have read that original essay mm-hmm. and have passed it on to their friends.
Right.
Hundreds of emails, encounters with hundreds of students at more than a dozen campuses, and professors, and people who, and parents, and people who've been dealing with this.
Right.
So I know what I'm talking about. Are my criticisms true of every single kid? Of course not. But that's I think a copying objection.
Sure.
Another big one is that my book starts by talking about how unhappy these kids are, and there's been a lot of resistance to that idea. The fact is that we know this. I mean, there's studies certainly of high school kids who are going through this, but also, again, I mean, a lot of the people are saying these kids seem perfectly happy to me, or they say kids have always been unhappy.
Right.
Yeah, kids have always been unhappy, but not like this. We're putting too much pressure on these kids, and they're cracking. And the closer you get to the situation, the more aware of it you are.
Mm-hmm.
High school teachers are aware of it. People in deans of students' offices and college counseling services are aware of it. Professors the relatively few who pay attention to their students are aware of it.
Right.
I would say those are a couple of the issues. I think I've sort of already addressed some of them.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting that, you know, you talk about these pressures and some of the things that we put on students today and in our system that we're maybe moving more into that goes beyond higher education and it's more systemic in education in general is, you know, we talk about these high stakes testing.
Yeah.
Do you see any connections to that? You know, what's going on with reforms and sort of secondary and early childhood education, things like that?
Yeah, it's complicated. I've thought about this, and I haven't thought it through to a satisfactory extent.
Mm-hmm.
There are two Americas in education, too, just as there are two Americas everywhere.
Right.
There's the 10%, and there's the rest, the other 90%. And I'm not sure how similar the experiences are. I mean, the sort of teaching to the test that happens in your typical public school, I think, is kind of about disciplining and punishing the lower classes, quite frankly, and creating sort of obedient workers and docile citizens.
Right.
The stuff that happens in the upper middle class, I mean, in some sense, it's sort of like teaching to the test. You're sort of living to the test, and the test is college admissions. It's really self-generated in a lot of ways. It's really sort of internal competition within the upper middle class. If there's a commonality, and to bring this back to sort of theoretical questions about education, it's the notion that education is purely instrumental,
right,
and that we shouldn't waste time with these things that can't be measured. And why would we want to give kids downtime? And ironically, the systems that we look to with envy, our East Asian competitors, they're trying to go in our direction.
Right.
I mean, they have, if anything, more test-driven, high-pressure systems than we do. And they've started to realize that they're missing something, and they're missing the precise thing that enables us to be a more creative economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, I lived in Korea for 3 years, and I have a lot of connections in East Asia. And so, you know, I can definitely see a lot of people there wanting their system to be closer to us. And it's kind of ironic that our system might be moving closer to theirs.
Absolutely. So you did see that there.
Yeah, I mean, I taught in a high school in outside of Seoul for a year, and you know, I had students that were be studying all day long, up until really late at night.
Right.
And it was just, you know, to pass this test. And once they got to their senior year, they cut like these conversational language classes that we had, and they just did, you know, went to this rote memorization. So I 100% saw what you're
referring to. Yeah. There was a piece in the Times, I don't know if you saw it, just this past Sunday, about South Korea and the cram schools and studying till 10 o'clock at night and how the kids are miserable.
Right.
The kids are, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the funny thing is you go to the school there and you say, "Hey, what did you do this weekend?" And they look at you like, "What do you mean? What did I do?" So, you know, let's hope maybe we don't, you know, go that far. But, you know, coming up to an end, is there anything else that you want to add just about your book that we didn't get to or that we didn't get to talk about so far?
I think we've covered a lot of it.
Okay.
I just hope people check it out for themselves and not just,
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, sure. Fantastic. I know that you, it's not even out yet technically, and you've got a lot of book tours coming up, but you know, what's next after this book? You know,
I have no idea. I can't see past this.
I see.
Probably I'll continue to write about education. I would also like to write about other things as I've been doing. I'm interested in a lot of things that are going on in American culture, and I see many of them as connected. I'll just leave you with one thought, because in the course of sort of writing about other things, I've circled back to something that I think is very relevant. I have a friend who has an MFA and an MBA, and her career is sort of at the intersection of art and business. And she talks about the difference between design thinking and art thinking. And design thinking is where you have a problem and you're trying to solve it. So you get from A to B. And art thinking is where you invent B. Mm-hmm. It's an open-ended exploratory process. And it's not about one being better than the other. It's about both being necessary. But what she sees in business and what I see in education is what she calls design thinking. We're teaching students how to get from A to B, how to solve a problem, and how to get from A to B in their life,
right?
I want to be an X. Instead of giving them the tools to invent a B.
Sure.
And invent a B in their own life. Maybe they want C, D, or E.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, you know, I know you probably can't even have a conception of it, but something, you know, another article coming out about some of these design skills, things like that. Okay. All right. Well, I do appreciate it. And I just encourage all our listeners to go check out Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. And I have to thank Dr. Bill Derezowitz. Thank you very much for your time. And I hope you guys learned something. Thank you.